This is the final major talk for this year's retreat, and I wanted to use this occasion of the last morning talk just to bring up or bring together some of the threads of what I've been saying over the last 9 days, so that whatever you've learned, whatever you've experienced, can be more meaningful to you all, so it can all be put in a very beautiful context. The whole purpose of me teaching in this way is in order that one can extend one's experience of meditation to the very deep levels. Sometimes it's difficult for one to attain a jhana in only 9 days, especially as it requires a lot of letting go of the past habits of mind. But nevertheless, because there is that aspiration to reach very high, it's usually the case that people manage to get that little way further. Because you are prodded and pushed and encouraged, that means that usually one's meditation goes a little bit deeper, if not now, later on. And because the whole idea of aspiration is to try to convince yourself through faith, through encouragement, that you can achieve something deeper, something more wonderful, something more profound. And very often it's just that quality of faith and confidence which overcomes one's own ideas of what one is able to do or not able to do. Which can be just a factor which breaks one through to experience these states. But even if you haven't experienced those states, some of you will have experienced something very close to jhanas, if not in the jhanas themselves. And just that very experience is so important in your practice and life as a Buddhist, if not on this retreat, in other retreats. Because so much of religions, philosophies, ideas in the world are all just based on believing somebody else. Believing books, believing teachers, even believing one's own ideas. Very rare do they come across the raw experience of spiritual illumination, for want of a better word. And just to be able to get deep enough into your mind to be able to see this as shimmering and radiant mind, to understand exactly what it is, to understand where the happiness, the blisses, the ecstasies of saints throughout the ages comes from, to be able to see this and experience it for yourself, gives one that foundation and experience which is essential in today's marketplace of religions and philosophies. Even in Buddhism itself, in our question time we've been talking about all different types of Buddhism, about Bodhisattvas and Mahayana and Vajrayana and Theravada and all sorts of other types of Buddhism. And we can argue at length forever and ever on whether these things are true or false. And we can go even back to scriptures and even though the original teachings of the Buddha will obviously have a lot of weight, even so it will not be convincing to those who don't want to believe. So the only course of action which is sensible is to try and encourage everybody to find out these truths for themselves. And it is not impossible to find out these truths in your own life. It just takes a little bit more of commitment, a little bit more of interest, to see if one can develop one's meditation so deeply that these things can be seen and touched for oneself. And this is just so important for the future of Buddhism in the world. In the time of the Buddha, not just monks and nuns, but what they call upasakas, upasikas, lay men and lay women who are devoted to the teachings and the practice, they achieve these states. And I know when I was young, I was told that monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha, they were special. They weren't like ordinary people these days, because they were born almost with psychic powers. That's why these days when someone has a baby, I always ask them, was your boy born without hair? Because if they were, that's a sign they're destined to become a monk. But so some people think there's just some predestination that those people in the time of the Buddha were somehow very special and somehow very wonderful and different than we are today. Fortunately, in my studies of Buddhism, I began my real study of the Buddhist texts by studying the Vinaya, the rules of discipline for monks and nuns. And that was quite an eye-opener, because in such works as the Therāgāta and Therīgāta, the verses of the enlightened monks and nuns, in some of the suttas, all you hear there is about the star monks, the star nuns, the ones who really did great deeds. But in the Vinaya, which are rules of discipline, you find out about the monks who got up to all sorts of mischief and did all sorts of stupid things. For example, one of the rules for a Buddhist monk and nun is it's an offensive pajiti. You've got to confess this offense to another monk if you tickle another monk. That's one of the 227 rules. You can't tickle anybody. And the reason behind that was that there was a group of six monks who were real scallywag monks. They really shouldn't have been monks. They were just in it for the nice food and adulation. And there's also these very young boy monks. And they got hold of one of these boy monks once and started tickling him just for the fun of it. And literally, according to the text, there was these six monks all around him tickling him, and he was short of breath and he died. And first of all, had a sort of heart attack. And first of all, they wondered whether that was a disrobing offence, because killing another human being, you have to disrobe. But they said it wasn't done intentionally. They didn't mean to cause death. They were just having some fun. But nevertheless, there was a rule there that you cannot tickle another monk. So you think that what would monks be doing, spending their time tickling one another? Those were real people. People who, so if you can identify with these days. For example, there was another story of the same group of monks. There was once, this was when Buddhism was getting well established in the time of the Buddha, and so all the rich people in town were inviting the Buddha and all these monks to eat in their house. And that some of these people born from poor backgrounds would only get sort of simple food. And this time as a monk you could eat at the best houses and get the most delicious food. So there was one very wealthy person in the town who said every day for the next so many months I'll invite six monks to come to my house for the dana, sort of once a week, oh no, every day, sort of in rotation. So when it got time for these six monks, they were on the roster to go the next day. According to the way it's said in the Vinaya, it said when they heard that they were going to eat at the house of the rich man the following morning, they did not sleep as much as expected. However, what had happened was that rich man had gone to the monastery the next day just to see the Buddha and hear a Dhamma discourse, and just in passing he said, oh, by the way, who's going to come to my house the following morning? And when he was told, that group of the six monks, he said, oh, not them. He said, yeah, well, you've got to be fair in the monastic community. It said they're going to go tomorrow. Okay. And so when he got home, he told his servant, he said, tomorrow these scallywag monks are going to come, so don't make the usual feast. Just give them sour gruel made of broken rice, which was the most lowliest and common of food, just like, Vegemite sandwiches instead of the real big meal. And don't even invite them into the house. Take them down to the store and make them eat down there. Because he had no respect for those monks. And so when those monks got there in the morning, they were expecting such a wonderful meal. And when they got sent down to the storeroom, they thought, well, they must be busy in the house. At least we get our feast. And when they got just the sour gruel with broken rice, they were fuming. They ate their meal, but when they got back to the monastery, they said they were leaning against the post of the entranceway, brooding, speechless. And they thought that one of the monks had put this lay person up to them. And so there's lots of stories as a result of that incident of these monks accusing the monk who ran the roster of doing all sorts of stupid things. They accused him of actually having sex with somebody else. His name was Dabba, and they said he had sex with this nun, Maitreya. And then when it was found, it was just an allegation, it wasn't true, so the monks had to confess an offence. So then they met together and said, that didn't work, let's try again. So they saw two goats on the hillside, a female and a male, having intercourse. And so they named one, I'm going to call him Dabba, and that one Maitreya. And then they went back to the Buddha and said, we actually saw it this time. We saw Dabba and Maitreya having sexual intercourse. And so another one. So I'm just mentioning this because it shows that even in the time of the Buddha, there were some very silly monks and nuns and lay people, just the same as there are silly people today. In fact, the quality of people, when you read the Vinaya, you find they're no different than people today. When I read that, it actually gave me a lot of confidence and faith. So I realized people in the time of the Buddha weren't special. They're very much the same as you and me. And because, you see, people in the time of the Buddha attaining all these wonderful things, and they're not special, it gives everyone faith that they too can attain these things. Sometimes, even some of the monks of monasteries say, now Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're a good meditator, you were probably born that way. I still carry, so there's some photographs with me of when I was a young man, before I became a monk. My hairstyle was a la Jimi Hendrix, my hero. It was called the donut look, because when my curly hair ended, that's when my beard started. I was not born like this. I used to have my green velvet trousers and hippie beads. And I mention that just to make sure that everyone realizes that you're not born into sort of deep meditation or wisdom. You grow into it, you attain into it. And a point of this whole part of this morning's talk is that it is possible for each one of you, no matter where you are now in your meditation practice, no matter how hopeless you think you are or how highly attained you think you are, you can still go further. You can still go deeper. Some of the most unlikely candidates gain very deep meditation and gain great insight. For those of you who think that you have to have university degrees to understand the Dhamma, that you have to be able to study all the books, all the Tipitaka and the Abhidhamma, to be able to understand the Dhamma, become enlightened. I always remember the story of this one monk in Thailand. When he was a young boy, he was put into the grade school. In those villages in that time, only had 4 years of schooling for everybody. Just grade 1, 2, 3, 4. Just so you could count and you could write your name, and that's about all. This poor young boy was so stupid at school. After 1 year of teaching, the teacher failed him for grade 1. He had to go again the next year. Second year, same thing happened. He failed grade 1 the second time. He just was not up to standard. The teacher could not pass him with his friends to go up the next year. Third year, in grade 1, he failed that again. 3 times at grade 1, and he couldn't pass it. So they threw him out of school. His parents thought he was, you know, really dumb and dull, was born with bad karma. And so what they used to do with stupid children in those days, send them to the monastery to become a monk. That's what they used to do. Because they thought there'd be no use at home, no use in the farm, because they were just sort of deficient somewhere. So this poor young boy was sent to the village monastery. At the village monastery, they weren't really into meditation. They weren't into sort of, you know, learning the chanting and going to people's houses and doing blessings and giving formal talks and doing all the ceremonies and rites and rituals of Buddhism. You know, like chanting for people, funerals and all that sort of stuff. So the very kind abbot there tried to teach him how to read and try and teach him how to remember the chanting. But it was hopeless. Now this abbot was so patient and spent so much time with this young boy, but he just could not learn anything. He was a hopeless case. And so even the abbot was at his wit's end what to do with this young boy. So as a last resort, he sent him to the meditation monastery, to the forest monastery, where you don't have to do so many rites and rituals and all this chanting and stuff. But sent him to that place. And when his teacher taught him how to meditate, just watch the breath. His mind was so simple, so peaceful. That's why he couldn't study. But when he got onto the breath, wham bang, straight into deep meditation. And he became one of the great meditation masters of Thailand. His mind was that peaceful and simple. So, there's hope for all of us. And I like that story because it shows that if you've got a peaceful mind, you can get into deep meditation very easy. If you've got a very sharp mind, a very intelligent mind, it's hard to get into deep meditation, but once you get in, you'll find heaps and heaps of insight there. Once or a while, get peaceful very quickly, but it's a hard time getting wisdom out. But if you've got a very sharp and intelligent mind, sometimes it's difficult to get in, but once you get in, wow, you can get so much wisdom out of that. So it all balances, really. It doesn't really matter about your intellect. What is more important is your degree of faith and confidence to give it a try, and especially the faith to keep on going. One of the marvellous things which about this path of Buddhism, which I hope you've seen in this retreat, is that when you carry out the instructions, when you do the right thing, meditation is fun. If that's all you learn of this retreat, that meditation is fun, then I'm happy as a teacher. Because I know if you take away fun from this meditation retreat back home, it means you'll come back, or you'll do meditation at home, or when it really gets fun, you really want to get into the fun palace and come and join a monastery or a nunnery somewhere, the fun palace. Simply because the Buddha said this was a gradual path to enlightenment. And that gradual path to enlightenment, according to the Buddha's teachings, at each stage is more and more sukha, more and more happiness. And you know you're following the right path if more and more happiness, more and more joy arises. That's a fair indicator you're going in the right direction. Sometimes people in the world say they're having a good time, but they're lying. They're just distracting themselves, and if they're really honest, they say they're lost, confused, haven't got a clue really what they're doing, and very afraid of death, of loss of loved ones, of sickness. In this meditation practice, there's more and more joy, more and more happiness, because it is the joy and happiness born of letting go, born of abandoning. It means it's secure. If it's a happiness born of attaining something, that's not secure at all. When you've attained, got that something, it will have to disappear. The happiness of letting go is something which will stay. Because it's not conditioned. It's born of unconditioning yourself. It's not born of attachment. It's born of detaching yourself. It's not born of imprisoning yourself. It's born of freedom. These are the happinesses of the path. These are the fruits of the path. This is how the Buddha called it, the paths and the fruits. All these fruits of Buddhism are very sweet and tasty. They're not bitter at all. That's why as a person becomes interested, involved, and starts to practice in this way, they start to experience more and more happiness inside. That happiness which you'll feel inside is that the happiness of letting go. In the gradual training, it starts just with the happiness of precepts. Just even keeping 5 precepts, or in this retreat 8 precepts or 9 precepts. It's a strange thing just how much happiness that brings to the mind, to the heart. And if you don't think you've got anything in this meditation, at least by your restraint, by keeping these precepts in these 8-9 days, you'll find that even that amount of practice will bring you a great feeling of happiness and peace. The Buddha even had a word for this, he called it anavajrasukha, the blameless happiness. This is a happiness which many people in the world do not recognize because they don't know blamelessness. They're always breaking precepts. But when you keep precepts for a long period of time, whether it's 5 precepts or 8 precepts, a happiness comes in the heart which is very delicious. A feeling of self-worth, a feeling of self-respect, a feeling of blamelessness, of lack of fear. This is what the Buddha said, if someone keeps the precepts in whatever assembly they go to, whatever group of people, they feel a sense of inner strength because they're no longer blameworthy in any respect. That strength, that sense of peace, that sense of ease is something immensely strong. Once you become mindful and aware of your inner feelings, you'll know the difference how you feel inside when you break a precept, when you just don't care about them, and how you feel inside when your precepts are pure. How you feel inside will be so much sense of ease, inner happiness, inner strength, what psychologists call self-worth. Why is it that many people go and see psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, and they claim that they hate themselves? They've got no sense of self-worth. In fact, sometimes they even want to kill themselves, commit suicide, or destroy themselves. Much of that is because of their lack of any precepts whatsoever. The lack of purity of the heart. When you get into deep meditation and you start getting nimittas up, you can actually see this with the eyes of your mind in the quality of that nimitta which comes up. If you've broken a precept or been slapped, that nimitta is dull. It does not shine. And as I mentioned, once you understand what these nimittas are to your own experiences, it is the reflection of your mind. You're looking at your own inner face, just as if you were looking in a mirror. And you understand why that nimitta is dull, why you can't get into jhanas, why it's not bright enough. There's something in your actions of body or speech. You can actually see that in the reflection of your mind. So this is not just a theory. You can either feel that emotionally, sensitively, or you can actually see that in the nimitta. But the lack of precepts stops you being happy. As simple as that. So when a person starts to follow precepts and starts to be pure in bodily conduct and speech, you find you get happier. Even monks who haven't got good meditation, as long as they keep their precepts, they're happy monks. But secondly, that when you start to let go of more and keeping precepts, that's all it is just letting go. Letting go of things which hurt and harm you, hurt or harm others. And you let go more and more, especially let go of business, past and future, let go of inner speech. At each stage, the more you let go, the happier you feel. This is what makes meditation work. It's not the will, it's not the choice, it's not you decide you're going to meditate. The fastest way to learn meditation is by action and reward. You do some action, you get a reward, then you do it again. Just like the rat in the psychology experiment. If it presses a button, it gets a lump of cheese. If it presses the wrong button, it gets an electric shock. That's what happens in your meditation. You press the right button, beautiful nimitta, oh, this is wonderful. You go trying, 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 and get the electric shocks. I mean, the pain, the suffering, the ill will, the frustration. It's actually training you to be a wise rat, to be a smart rat in the cave, in the cave of the mind. So you can learn how to press the right buttons. And as soon as the rat presses the right button, as soon as you might have pressed the wrong button for weeks and weeks and weeks, as soon as you press the right button, there you get the reward. Ah, peace, bliss, ease, isn't this wonderful, isn't this lovely? You get so happy. That is what we're teaching meditation. I can go on talking for hours and hours and hours. Ajahn Chah can give teachings so long. This is how Ajahn Chah remember teachings. This is common. Just before he got sick, he had on a big festival day when he had about 1,000, 2,000 people in his monastery. And he got up to give the talk. And he didn't talk about jhanas. He didn't talk about enlightenment. He didn't talk about all these high things. He said, right, I've been teaching you 30 years in this monastery. Please put your hands up if you're keeping 5 precepts for life. And only about 2 people out of 1,000 put hands up. You see? You're all dog poo. That's what you are, dog poo. And that's how he taught. That's typical Ajahn Chah. Dog poo, that's all you are. And people loved it because they recognised, yeah, you're right. But this is how Ajahn Chah used to teach, and it was right. I could say, yeah, that's right, because he was actually saying he can teach and teach and teach. He can be one of the most inspiring teachers in the whole of Thailand and give his amazing discourse and have thousands of people coming every week. But how many people are actually putting into practice? And this is why the practice which you get is worth so much more, a million times more than any book or any sermon, even by the Buddha. You've all heard Four Noble Truths: suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, the path leading to the end of suffering. Many people can recite it in Pali, and they can explain each word in depth what it means. The Buddha said, if you understood the Four Noble Truths, you would be a stream winner. So what is it? What's the difference between the words and the meaning? The difference is this. When you've been practicing meditation, every time you've let go, really let go, you've been following and experiencing the Third Noble Truth. The Third Noble Truth says that Nibbana, the ceasing of suffering, the bliss that is Nibbana, happens through Chago, Muti, Patinisago, Analayo. Chago means giving up. Patinisago means forfeiting, giving away. Muti means freeing. This is not muti, this is the opposite. This is clinging. That's muti. Opening your arm, your hand, opening your mind. Not clinging, not grasping, not craving, not controlling. Muti. And analayo. Analyo means detaching. These are the Third Noble Truth. You may have heard those words and think, I understand those words, letting go, detaching. And so many people can write books about detachment. As I've mentioned in my newsletter article, there's one very famous guru who said, I am so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. Which sounds really smart, doesn't it? And that was his excuse for having sexual intercourse, drinking, and doing all sorts of terrible things. And anyone who was actually letting go, he said, you're just attached to detachment. He said, you monks, you're just attached to letting go, that's all. Okay, those are very nice words, and they can be smart. People actually believe those things are so stupid. But the words and the meaning are so different. If you really are letting go, you're really practicing that Third Noble Truth, what happens? Your meditation starts to take off. Your mind becomes so peaceful. And you let go. All of these paths which I've just been teaching at all this retreat happens all by itself. You just sit there and just watch all these things happen. You just sit there in the present moment. Just watch. As one meditator said during this retreat, they were just watching the present moment and just silence just flowered from within. And it was just an easy silence, just a peaceful silence, an effortless silence. It just came all by itself. I didn't go seeking it out or controlling it. It just happened. They learned how to press the button of the Third Noble Truth. Stay in that silence and the breath appears. I had to find this out. You know what it is sometimes? You're watching the breath, try to watch the breath. I remember as a young monk sometimes sitting for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes, trying to find the breath, never really be able to get a handle on it, never being able to keep it in mind. But at that time I was also trying to do some letting be meditation, just let go. So after 45 minutes of struggle, trying to find the breath, I said, okay, I'm going to give up that meditation object, just let it be, let go. You know the first of which came into my mind? The breath. Nice, clear, stable, without any effort. The breath, and it was just there for the rest of the meditation. That taught me something. I've been struggling for 45, 50 minutes, trying to get the breath, and as soon as I let go, up comes the breath. Is this some kind of joke? I realized that it wasn't any joke. I was teaching me a lesson there. If you really want to hold the breath, find the button of the Third Noble Truth, let go, and the breath will come all by itself and stay as long as you want. It was teaching me that the whole path of meditation is all about giving up control, letting go, just being the watcher. Just getting the process started, just by sitting down and do a little bit of effort in the beginning, but then things just happen by themselves. It's a natural process. This is why, if you want to know the path to enlightenment, the Eightfold Path, or what the Buddha said, as soon as Pamuja, this happiness, comes up in the mind, automatically that gives rise to piti, this inner joy, which gives rise to tranquility of the body of the mind, which gives rise to inner happiness, which gives rise to samadhi, to jhana, which gives rise to seeing things as they truly are, which gives rise to viraga, the fading away of things, which gives rise to cessation, which gives rise to nibbana. And there's one sutta which comes to mind right now. It's a beautiful sutta. He said, for one who has this pamuja, this inspiration, they don't need to think to make a determination. May I experience this piti, this inner joy. And the Buddha said, because it's natural, it's automatic, it happens despite whatever you determine or say, that in one who has this pamuja, this inspiration, that joy arises. And for one who has joy, this piti, they do not need to think to determine, oh, may my body be tranquil, may my mind be tranquil. Because it happens as a natural cause, monks. That in one whose mind has piti, this joy, the body does become tranquil, the mind becomes tranquil. It's automatic, it just happens. And the Buddha continued, in one whose mind is tranquil, whose body is tranquil, they do not need to think to make a resolution. Oh, may I experience the inner happiness of sukha, the beauty of the mind. Because it's a natural course, it happens whether you like it or not, that in one whose mind is tranquil, body is tranquil, sukha, this inner happiness, comes up. In one whose mind has this inner quality of happiness, of ease, of beauty, they do not need to make a resolution to determine, oh, may my mind enter samadhi, enter jhanas. It is natural, it happens as automatic, that in one whose mind experiences this inner ease, the samadhi arises. And in one whose mind has samadhi, they do not need to make a resolution to decide, oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens as a natural course, it's dhammata, naturally occurring. That in one whose mind has samadhi, they see things as they truly are. This is why sometimes people ask me, well, after jhana, what do you do next? Nothing. It's a natural course. Insight will happen normally, naturally. It's dhammata. It's a natural progression. That's what the Buddha said. You don't need to think, oh, may I see things as they truly are. No more do you resolve once you climb up the top of the mountain, oh, may I see the view. You can't help seeing the view unless you're blind. You have to see it. And you don't, for one who sees things as they truly are, you don't need to think, to plan, to make a resolution. Oh, may I become dispassionate towards the world. It happens as a natural course, you can't stop it. You do become dispassionate towards the world. For one who becomes dispassionate towards the world, they don't need to think to make a determination, oh, may I become enlightened. It's a natural thing, it happens despite whether you want it or not. If you see things as they truly are and you become dispassionate, you become enlightened. Once you're enlightened, you don't need to make the resolution to think, to plan, oh, may I end samsara, may this be my last birth. It happens as a natural course. When you're enlightened, this is your last birth. This is like Dhamma. It's a natural process. That's why, essentially, because of the truth, once this process is started, you can't stop it. You can't delay it. You can't actually say, when a process is started, I'm going to put off my enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. You just can't do that. It's like being on a bus. It's an express bus. It's only got one stop. Enlightenment. It's like those of you going back to Singapore. Once you're on the plane in Perth, you can't tell the plane driver, oh, can you please stop in Darwin? Can you please stop in Jakarta? Can you please stop in Bali? I want to see Bali. You can't, so once you're on that plane, say, I refuse to get to Singapore until all my friends who are still in Perth get to Singapore. You can't do that. It's against the natural law. Once you're on that plane, bound to Singapore, that's it. Singapore is the next stop. You can bang on the door, you just get arrested by the flight attendants, that's all. You can't hijack the plane to Nirvana. One direction only. That's actually quite worrying for many people, because they think, I've still got many things to do in my life. I'm sorry, but it's too late now. You might go home and think, oh yeah, this meditation, this Ajahn Brahm, he keeps on telling us we should all be, I'm not going to become a monk, I'm not going to become a monk. And after a while, oh, I guess I better become a monk. You might as well bite the bullet and do it. Because you're going to have to sooner or later. Once you hear these teachings, once you taste that bliss of the mind, that's it. That's what happened to me anyway. As soon as I tasted that bliss of the mind, I was a graduate from Cambridge. I could do all sorts of things in my life. I could probably become rich if I wanted to. But even though, say, the world was at my feet, those deep meditation experiences could not be forgotten, could not be put out of my mind. That's why I really became interested in Buddhism. I wanted to find out more and deeper about that experience. That was the most joyful thing I'd ever experienced. You want to find out more about that joy. You can't forget it. You're finding out a truth and a happiness which is Ehi Pasika Opanayaka, which invites you. It's alluring. It just keeps bringing you in, the Opanayaka, and leading you on. It leads you on and on and on until you get to Nirvana. And you say, thank you for leading me on. Every stage of this process, you get more and more happiness, more and more bliss. You never regret this. I never regretted 1 minute of monastic life, or one decision to join the monastery. I've been, the other monks, it's strange, other monks sort of have always been struggling to stay as a monk. So after about 3 or 4 days with Ajahn Chah, so the realization was, I'm in this for life. I told other monks that, and I said, look, I'm going to be a monk for life. And said, yeah, we've heard that before. I just can't wait to see this. I told you so. Because these are realizations which you get along the way. The happiness of Buddhism, the happiness of meditation, the sheer wisdom of it is so alluring. And this is why I've taught in this way, so you can actually see these noble truths which you read about. You're seeing them not in the page of a book, you're seeing them in your meditation. Every time you let go, you get really close to Nirvana. You feel the taste of Nirvana, the bliss of Nirvana. You know, one of the descriptions the Buddha gave to first jhana, he called it Sambodhisukha. Sambodhi Sukha literally means the bliss, the happiness of enlightenment. That's what the Buddha called the bliss of first jhana. That's powerful. He would say that's the happiness of enlightenment. That's not enlightenment, but he said the meaning was it's so close, you're getting so close to these things, that it's worthwhile calling that the happiness of nibbana, the happiness of enlightenment. Sambodhi means enlightenment. And there's a good meaning to that. You're getting so close, you're getting a good idea of what all this enlightenment business is about. You know what people in the world think enlightenment is? They think enlightenment is really boring. No television, no alcohol, no sex, no money, no movies, no sport. This enlightenment must be really dull and boring. Some years ago, when I used to go teaching at the prison down in Karnet, which was just down the road from the monastery, about 8 kilometres away, the arrangement was that the monastery would take me there and one of the prison officers would drive me back. So every Tuesday afternoon, I think it was, a different prison officer would drive me back for the monastery. It's only 5 minutes. But one of the prison officers was driving me back one day in a prison van, and some of the prison officers, people working there, are pretty rough characters. And this one character was driving me back, and you know, he got to know me, and so he said, "Look, what do you guys get up to up there, you know, down in the monastery? I'd like to know, if you don't mind telling me." He said, "Are there any women up there?" I said, no, monks are celibate, we don't have any sex." "Oh, is there any alcohol up there, any hooch, do you take alcohol?" I said, no, we don't have any alcohol, we don't drink alcohol." And he said, "Any drugs?" "No, we don't take drugs." He looked at me and paused. He said, "Well, what do you guys do up there then?" And he couldn't understand, you know, why. No, intelligent young men sort of were spending their life in a monastery when there's so many other things they could be doing. And a lot of people in the world say that. You say you're just sitting there meditating all day. So it's really boring. You know, no televisions, no radios, no CDs, no parties. No. For many people, they think that's the most boring thing ever. You know that story about that monk who's very COVID, though. He went down to Canning Vale jail. No, sorry, not Canning Vale, Casuarina jail, one of the high security prisons there. And he was teaching meditation down there. And after a few weeks, you know, first of all, the prisons don't really open up to you because they're a bit scared of you, you don't really know them. Then after a while, they started just chatting to him about other things. You know, they got sort of used to him. He said, what's the life of the monastery anyway? So what do you do?" And he said, "No, we sort of meditate all day, we only have one meal a day, we sleep on the floor." And the guys in the prison were astounded. "That's terrible, they make you do that?" And they forgot themselves. They said, "Why didn't you come in here and stay with us? It's much better." He said that. "Why didn't you come in here and stay with us?" And the next week he came. He said it was really funny. The next week he came. They took so much pity on this poor monk that they had this big tray of cheeses and chocolates and all different types of teas and honey. Because they thought this monk was just this great poverty in our monastery. They don't realize we actually enjoy that. There's a lot of happiness there. So for many people, like enlightenment seems to me the most boring, suffering, torturous thing. And that's why many people don't aspire on that path. But here, in this meditation retreat, you've been living a much more ascetic life than any prison in Australia. Even in prisons, they allow you to see the television in the evening. They give you a meal in the evening. If Amnesty International found out about me, I'd be in big trouble. I'd make you sit on the floor, torture yourself, torture your knees. I give you interrogations once every 2 days. And you even have to pay for it. Crazy, isn't it? So the point is that in the world, people think you're really stupid and crazy. One of the beautiful sayings of the Buddha is, "What the world says is happiness, the enlightened one says is suffering." What the world says is suffering, the enlightened one says happiness. And many of you have experienced that for yourself. If you tell your friends who aren't Buddhists what you've done, they think you're absolutely crazy. But if you tell your friends what you felt, they'd be so jealous. Many of you in this retreat have felt some beautiful happiness. Some of the happiness that you have felt in this retreat has exceeded anything you've experienced at any time in your life. That is only the beginning. More is to come. The more you get into this meditation, the more happiness, the more bliss you get. More and more and more. Give me more and more and more. You get so much bliss sometimes, you just wonder how you can take any more. But as I said, you can. You find some way or other of getting some more bliss in. And it doesn't happen because you want it. It happens because you let go. And you're realizing that this is the path to happiness, the path to bliss. It's also realizing Buddha's noble truths. When you let go, it leads to nirvana. And nirvana's happiness. The ultimate happiness. You also learn the second noble truth. What's the second noble truth? Craving gives rise to suffering. What does craving mean? I want to get jhana. I want to get enlightened. I want to let go. I want to get peaceful. I've been sitting here for so long. I want to get peaceful. Come on! How many of you have done that for the last 8 or 9 days? And where has it got you? Where it's got you is you've learned some more about the second noble truth. But I know the second noble truth, I won't get the third noble truth. But at least you're learning, you're understanding, and little by little, I mean, eventually you have to let go. There's no two ways about it. Even the slowest of meditators, eventually something happens and they let go. Sometimes years and years and years people meditate and then something happens. If any of you ever get despondent or frustrated about the practice of Buddhism or your practice of Buddhism, go and read the Theragatha or the Therigatha. These are the poems of the enlightened monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha. They're just so inspiring. They're inspiring because you find these are the Buddhist saints. They tell you what it was like to become a saint. All the struggle they went through. All the difficulties they went through. And you can relate to all of those. I've already mentioned one of them about the nun. 7 years or 6 years she was meditating. And not a moment's peace in those 6 years. Not 9 days, 6 years. Imagine in this retreat, 6 years, going through this and getting absolutely nowhere. But then she managed to, because she let go, she finally broke through and got an enlightenment experience. Other monks, 17 years, Aniruddha, before he got his first enlightenment experience. And he was a cousin of the Buddha. He was the meditator at the Buddha's death who had such great powers of mind, you could actually see the Buddha was in cessation. He hadn't died yet. No other monk could know that at that time. But it took him 17 years to get his enlightenment experience. Other monks, poor old Ananda, 80 years before he became enlightened. Even for those of you who are really slow, there was one man in the time of the Buddha who was so slow that he only became a monk when he was 120 years of age. And it's just what happened. 120 years of age, he became a monk. A couple of months later, he became fully enlightened, an arahat. A couple of months later, he died. It's called leaving it up to the last moment. Not to be encouraged. But he did it. But he showed even a 120-year-old person could do it. Could actually become a monk. So I think, Letty, you're the oldest person here, 85. There's still plenty of time for you to become a nun, to become fully enlightened. At 85, you're still a youngster. You've got another 35 years to go. So this actually shows what's possible. It gives you the confidence and faith just to keep on going. Whatever happiness you've enjoyed, contemplate on that, reflect upon it, have fun with it, celebrate it, and that happiness and joy will increase. Any suffering and pain which you've experienced in this retreat, contemplate on it, reflect upon it, and learn from it. That's how to be a fast learner. Don't just suffer for suffering's sake and don't learn from it, because if you don't learn from it, you'll have to go through the lesson again. Learn from it. What did you do wrong? Look at it in terms of the Buddha's noble truths, the second and third noble truth. The Buddha said if it hurt, if it was suffering, if it was frustrating, it's because there's some craving there somewhere. Identify it. Find out what you've been doing. Learn. If there's any happiness that's arisen, it's because you've let go. Identify that letting go. Learn about it. Recognize it so you can do it again. And that way you become more experienced, more efficient meditators, more happy Buddhists. And if any of you are really into trying to share these teachings with others when you go home, it's a waste of time going and say Buddhism is really great with a frown on your face or getting angry at them. If Buddhism is really great, it should show in your face, it should show in your speech, it should show in your actions. Many people know these days it's all about marketing, image. So if you so if you want to help Buddhism spread in the world, image, image, image. Smile. Be peaceful, be happy. That's what attracts people to Buddhism. That's what attracted me to Buddhism. When I was a young Buddhist in London, I was ecumenical. I went around to the Tibetan monks, to the Sri Lankan monks, the Burmese monks, to the Thai monks, the Japanese monks. And the reason why I went to Thailand to become a monk was because of all those monks, of all those traditions, even the Chinese monks included, the Thai monks smiled the most. Tibetans were a close second, but the Sri Lankans were a long way behind, I'm afraid. I think they're getting better these days. Especially lovely monks like Ananda Maitreya and Piyadasi, people like that, very nice. But the monks I saw in London didn't smile. And I thought that actually was very important to me, because from all their teachings they could be very profound. If they weren't happy, I thought, well, what's the point of this practice? This is supposed to end suffering, which is what Buddhism is supposed to do. Then they hadn't ended it. So this this was so important. If you want to spread Buddhism and help other people, then show that you've ended some suffering. At least you're on the way to ending suffering. So you're at ease, at peace, happy, smiling. If not smiling outside, smiling inside. With the happiness of attainment. When King Pasenadi went to visit the Buddha just before King Pasenadi died, when he went through the Jeta Grove Monastery at Sawati into the Buddha's hut, one of the first things he said to the Buddha, he said, I'm so inspired coming into this monastery because I see all these monks, many young monks, smiling and happy. He said, surely it must be because they're enjoying some of these attainments on the path. He said, yeah, that's true. When King Ajatasattu came to see the Buddha, he said, why are all these people becoming monks? For happiness. He said, surely it can't be happiness. I'm a king. I have all this harem. I eat whatever I want. And the Buddha explained to him that your happiness as a king is not worth anything compared to the happiness of me. But can you sit in meditation for 7 days experiencing bliss, 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 bliss? Even in your heart, you can experience happiness for an hour or two. You can't match the happiness of an enlightened one. And that got the king, who was into sensory pleasures, very interested. That's actually my marketing technique when I first went into jail to teach meditation. I went in there, and all these men in jail, and I said the bliss of meditation is much better than sexual orgasm. And I had them there for the next hour. They were really interested. Marketing. Depending on your audience. Because they weren't sort of highbrow intellectuals, these were sort of ordinary prisoners. So this is actually what happens. The happiness of meditation, the happiness of Dharma, the happiness of practice is what will keep you going and will inspire others. It's not your words and your knowledge, it's your experience which counts. So if you can't meditate for yourself, meditate for the sake of all sentient beings. Meditate for the happiness of others, so they too can also experience the same happiness which you experience. And then you don't really need to teach them very much. Just smile a lot. Be kind, be gentle, be compassionate. And that will be the window to your own attainments. So this is bringing it all together. What you've been doing here is just learning about Four Noble Truths, especially the second and third Noble Truth. You've been learning about attachments. You know all these people who write about attachments, you shouldn't be attached. You don't know really what attachments are. Attachments are that which stops you getting into jhana. That's a very good definition. Attachments are what stops you getting into jhana. If you've got no attachments, there's nothing holding you back. You can let go. Why can't I let go? It's because all these things are clinging onto you. That's why. Don't be taken in by people who say that meditating is attachment. Because if you let go of meditation, you'll never get into jhanas. You never get enlightened. Don't get taken in by people who say, you're just attached to becoming enlightened. You're just attached to this. If it's an attachment, it's what blocks you getting into jhanas. If it helps you get into a jhanas, it's not an attachment, it's a letting go. Many people in the world call attachments letting go. And they call letting go attachments. They get it the other way around. So this is actually how to practice. Some people say, monks are just attached to celibacy. They should let go and enjoy sexuality. They should, hang loose. This is hanging loose. This is letting go. This is giving up attachments, giving up craving. That's why if you let go, give up craving, this is the result. So, understand what attachment is. You've seen attachments in your own mind. You've seen when attachments get overcome when you let go. Attachments are what stop you getting into jhana. That's the best test for them. So you know for yourself what's attachment, what isn't an attachment. What stops you being free. So you're learning a lot of Dharma in this retreat. Not so much from words, but from experience. And it's experience which counts. So you've learned a lot. From the notes you've taken, they're not worth very much at all. It's the experience you've had. That's what's worth the most. So, take this experience back with you. You'll remember this and you will look back upon this experience of this retreat. And what happens very often, it's really quite strange. Seeds have been planted, things are in motion, in your mind somewhere. And sometimes the best insights, the deepest realizations come after the retreat is finished. Some days later. Because it's the simile of the donkey again. You've been chasing that carrot running very fast. When you leave this retreat, you stop. And sometimes when you go on a plane back to Singapore, or you go back to Sydney, or you go back home, wherever, just the carrot is on its trajectory. And sometime in the next few days, week or whenever, when you least expect it, the carrot pops into your mouth all by itself. And deep insights arise. Fascinating that. Sometime after the retreat, you're sitting there somewhere, the mind opens up. Wait and watch. See what happens. So the retreat doesn't stop today. You're on the bus, you're on the aircraft. It's only pausing for a while. So the retreat pauses this afternoon at 3:30. It's going to begin again Monday soon. Have fun.